Hello and welcome back to Instant Mom, navigating solo foster and adoptive motherhood while attempting a go at sanity. So full disclosure, I am recording this as I'm driving. It's fine because it's hands-free, which is really nice. And there's not a lot of traffic because we are still under a stay-at-home order. But you guys, I just couldn't deal with being in my house for one more second. I can't remember if I mentioned this on the last episode, but we have a nanny that has come to our house since I'm just not comfortable sending Jack to daycare. It reopens in a couple of weeks. And, you know, before that, obviously, his daycare was closed. We bit the bullet and got a nanny, and we actually have two nannies that are splitting the days, both college students who are home because of college being held online. And they are awesome. They're friends. They have been socially distancing themselves. And I'm sure Jack appreciates being able to play with somebody besides me. So that's been really, really great because, frankly, you just can't work with a three-year-old. It's impossible. So it's been nice to have the nanny so that I can work and also so that I can get out of the house a little bit, even if it just means driving around the neighborhood in my car while I talk to you people. So it is May, and May is the best month of the year. Okay, maybe December is better, but just barely. And May is the best month of the year for a number of reasons. First of all, it's my birthday month, May 10th, in case anybody wants to, you know, get me a present. And my birthday is on Mother's Day. So obviously that is significant. May is also the month that I adopted Jack. May 30th was the day that we legally became a family after almost 2 years together. So that's huge. And May is National Foster Care Awareness Month. So just lots of really big things to celebrate and talk about in May, which is really exciting. So for National Foster Care Awareness Month, I thought I would do a podcast episode on my very first placement. I'm really excited that I have a lot of new followers who have found me who are just starting the licensing process or are thinking about becoming a foster parent. And I love talking to people who are newly interested in foster care or who are just starting their journey. There are so many questions and there are so many unknowns that's just intrinsic to foster care in general. And so I know when I was starting the process, I was so hungry for any advice, experience, stories that I could get my hands on. So I'm really happy and excited that I can do that for some of you out there. So I got the call for a placement probably, I want to say, 3-ish weeks after I found out that I was officially licensed. The licensing process took about 5 months for me, which I think is actually pretty fast. And I do an episode, I think it's one of the first episodes in this podcast, about the licensing process if you want to know more about how that works. So I was really, really eager. Like, I was ready to go. And I'm just an impatient person anyway. And so when I decide I want to do something, like, I want to do it yesterday. And so I kept calling my placement worker, I kept calling my licensing worker. So when you're a foster parent, you're assigned sort of your own caseworker who is in charge of making sure you have everything you need, making sure that your all your paperwork is up to date, things like that. And I just kept calling her and texting her and emailing her, and I'm sure just like annoying the crap out of her, being like, "Hi, haven't received any calls. Can I help? Can I help? Can I help?" And this was when Indiana was in a particularly dire situation. We still desperately need more foster parents, but this 4 years ago was sort of at the height of the opioid epidemic. And so it was on the news almost every night, like, you know, the Department of Child Services desperately needs more foster parents. And so it was so frustrating to see all of these news stories and to hear all these things. And you're like, "Hello, I'm licensed and I'm open, like, give me a kid." So it seemed like I waited forever. I think it was probably only 2, maybe 3 weeks. And I remember I was driving along a windy road, much like I am doing now, because back before I had kids, I would just go for long drives when I wanted to think. And so I just kept going for all these long drives, hoping that my phone would ring. And finally, on this particular drive, it did. And I was so excited. And I think when the placement worker called me, they said, we have an African-American baby girl and she is 3 months old and she was removed because of domestic violence in her home. And are you interested? And I think the placement worker is used to foster parents asking more questions or saying, hey, can I just have half an hour to think about it? Because immediately, I think before she even finished saying those few words, I was like, yes, yes, absolutely, we'll take her. And I remember her kind of like laughing at me like, oh, you must be a new foster parent. And I was so excited. And so I turned around and started driving home. And I called my mom and I started crying. I was like, I'm having a baby. I was very dramatic about the whole thing. But it really did feel like I found out that I was pregnant and went into labor all in the span of that one phone call. So I called my mom and I was crying because I was so excited and like happy to help out and just overwhelmed with emotions. And I get home and, you know, all of my stuff had been ready. I also do an episode, about preparing for your first placement and specifically preparing for baby. So check that out for more detail there, but everything was ready. I had the nursery all furnished and decorated. I had all the baby stuff, a bunch of baby clothes, like the bottles, the formula, I was ready. So I got home and I kind of took everything out of the nursery and positioned, you know, the baby, positioned like the little bassinet in the living room and started making some bottles that when she got there, I would be all ready. And I quickly flipped through the book, What to Expect the First Year, and opened the page to the 3-month-old stage. And I still do this now when I get a call for a placement and I say yes, I immediately go to What to Expect the First Year and just sort of refresh my memory by reading a couple of pages about what's happening at that stage. Because, you know, from a 3-month-old to a 5-month-old, you wouldn't think there'd be a lot of difference in a schedule, but there's a lot. So I quickly like typed up a schedule and I just sort of waited for the caseworker to get there. I think that's a helpful tip that I'll just stop and point out is, here comes a police car. Not pulling me over. Isn't this such a professionally produced podcast, you guys? This is why when people are like, oh, don't you do a podcast? I get very embarrassed because while I'm very glad that this can be helpful to people and I hope it's helpful to people, I definitely do not consider it any kind of remotely professional podcast. It is a series of voice memos that I produce. I don't even want to say produce. It is a series of voice memos that I upload when I have the time. I digress. But so anyway, one thing I do is I read that chapter about that particular stage and then I type out a schedule. Now, obviously, all babies are different and they don't all want to adhere to a particular schedule. And you don't really know what kind of schedule your baby is going to be on or what kind of temperament they will have, which sort of dictates the schedule until you've been able to be with them for a couple of days. But I found that if you at least go into it with an idea of what the schedule should be, you know, okay, roughly I know that this baby needs to eat every 3 hours. And oh, and here comes a fire truck, guys. This is going really well. Okay, maybe that's it for now. But when you know roughly, okay, they need to eat every 3 hours and they need to eat 6 to 8 ounces and they should be having 2 naps a day and they should be around 1.5 hours and they should theoretically be sleeping 14 hours a night with 2 feedings in the middle. When you have those general guidelines, I think that's really helpful to at least know where to start with them. And then from there you can adjust, you know, if you get them and you find that they prefer to eat more and space the feedings fewer apart, or maybe they eat a little less and you feed more frequently. Like you can make those adjustments, but at least having a general roadmap to go from is enormously helpful because for me, and I'm sure for a lot of other people, when you get that placement, you're overwhelmed and those first few days are just really hectic and crazy. And if you don't have anything to start from, it's just easy to get really behind. And also, especially with young babies, having that schedule can help you understand why they might be upset. You know, there are only so many variables with a baby. They're in some kind of pain or uncomfortable, they're bored, they're tired, they're hungry, they're wet or dirty, and that's kind of it. And so if you can get them on a schedule really quickly, even if it's not a perfect schedule, then you can start to understand what their cries mean and what their cues are, and, you know, eliminate possibilities, by knowing that they've eaten recently, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, definitely even before the baby shows up at your doorstep, have a general outline of a schedule that you can start to, align them with. So, I did that. I was ready. The caseworker calls, and I was pretty naive. I think I can be a naive person in general because I like to think that, everybody is just a really good person and everybody, is just as excited about things as I am. And so I really thought the caseworker would, you know, bring the baby in, sit with me for 45 minutes or so, kind of just talk to me while I'm holding the baby, maybe, you know, hold the baby while I warm up her first bottle. You just kind of like be there to support us, you know, for the first hour or so. I knew she wasn't going to stay very long because she's a busy woman. She's got a million other cases, but I thought there would at least be some kind of transition period. I could ask some questions about her case. You know, this would all be very lovely. That is not what happened. That is not what ever happens. The caseworker like steps in my door. This the most beautiful baby I've seen in my life is asleep in her car seat, her little infant carrier. And she puts her down on the floor and she gets out some paperwork and she has me sign a few pieces of paper saying, you know, congrats, this baby is yours for the time being. And then she like starts to leave. And I'm like, I was like, when's the last time she ate? And the woman looks at me like I'm an idiot. And she's like, I don't know. I just removed her from a home. Like, I don't know when she ate last or, you know, if she ate last. And I'm like, what kind of formula was she on? I don't know. No idea. You know, like, of course, the caseworkers oftentimes don't have an idea. But I was asking all these questions as if, you know, I was babysitting and picking up from somebody else's schedule and not, you know, getting an infant from a very chaotic household. So I think she stayed all of 4 minutes, maybe. And when she left, I just remember staring at this baby and immediately having a panic attack. Immediately. Just the huge responsibility sank in of like, holy shit. Like, I am now responsible for keeping a human being alive, for keeping this very tiny, fairly fragile, little tiny baby alive. It's all my responsibility, and I've never done this before. I had nannied for newborns and babies before, but again, I'd always had a very detailed schedule to follow, and I was terrified. I just started panicking, and then I started panicking about like, oh my God, like my life is over as I know it. Like, I have a child now. I can't go out tonight. I can't sleep in tomorrow morning. And of course I knew all of those things before, but it's different when it's actually happening to you, especially because again, you don't have a lot of notice. It's not as if you have 9 months of pregnancy to know that there's a date that you're counting down toward, right? It's just like all of a sudden it's here. So I started panicking and I started crying. And then the baby girl started crying. As it turns out, she was a very hard to console baby, as almost all of my babies have been. And with my nerves and her nerves, I was just a hot mess. So I called my mother sobbing and my mom came over, and it was my mom and baby and I on the couch. And it was just quite a hot mess. And I was already exhausted within a few hours. And I had no idea that a baby could be exhausting during the day. I had this great vision of, well, you know, babies are going to be so easy. Like I will, I had a job where I could work remotely. So I was like, I will just work from my little home office and baby will just sleep and coo next to me the whole time. And I don't need a babysitter. I don't need daycare. This is just going to be so amazing and peaceful and cozy. And that's not how babies typically work. I mean, yes, they do sleep a lot, but they're also very needy. You know, every 3 hours you're feeding them. And I didn't take into consideration that, you know, a baby of that age takes about half an hour to get through a bottle, sometimes even a little more. And so by the time you finish one feeding, you've got about 2.5 hours until you're doing it again. And when you're trying to do laundry and work and take meetings and just, you know, keep up with your household responsibilities, it's just a pretty constant pace. And because baby girl was really colicky, she didn't do a lot of peaceful sleeping. She did a lot of screaming her head off. And so it was just a lot of exhausting work. So one thing that I did really well, in addition to having a schedule to start to align her with, was immediately putting her in the baby carrier. So, you know, baby carriers, I think, are so amazing and helpful for babies, no matter what their situation is, whether it's your own biological baby, an adoptive child, a foster child. Like, they're magical and lovely. It allows you to have both hands free while they're tucked snugly close to you, and they find it soothing and comforting. But particularly with children in foster care, it can really help advance bonding, because, you know, this poor little girl has been removed from the only home environment she knows. And even if it wasn't a very good home environment, it was familiar. She recognized the smells and the sounds, and she recognized her mother's touch and her mother's scent and her mother's voice. And now all of a sudden, she is in this very strange alien place. And so to sort of help with that bonding and that attachment and helping her feel like she is safe and she is secure, I immediately put her in a baby carrier. I really prefer just the classic Baby Bjorn. I have tried every baby carrier on the market. I have hated most of them. The classic Baby Bjorn is the way to go. And I just tucked her into that thing, and I wore her all the time. If she wasn't eating, and if she wasn't sleeping at night, and if she wasn't having tummy time, she was on me. And I think that really helped to calm her as best as we could, and to help her feel like she was safe and secure. So that is still something I do immediately. Now it's kind of a necessity with Jack, because I can't just put a baby down. Jack will try to like smother the baby, not intentionally. He just wants to hug the baby very tight and doesn't realize that newborns can't get a giant bear hug. But I think that is a great thing to do. Like, immediately wear that baby and start that bonding process and help them understand that they are safe and that they are secure and that they are loved. That's huge. So it was, a really rocky go. Baby had visitation really early. Another great thing that I am happy I did was to start a relationship with BioMom really quickly. I got this idea from somebody else, but that was to start a journal that you can put in the diaper bag when the baby goes to visits. And I just got a blank notebook, and I wrote a letter to Mom on that first page, and I introduced myself. I mean, not last names or a location, of course. And just said, you know, I'm foster mom. I'm so happy that I can help you during this time. And I said, you know, I promise to love and care for your daughter as if she were my own. And I'm so happy for you to have a chance to rebuild your life. And we are rooting for you. And, you know, I'll send photos and updates. And if you have any questions, please feel free to write them in this notebook, and we can communicate back and forth. And I think that that's really helpful. I mean, I can't imagine if somebody took Jack away from me and I didn't know where he was going. You know, I understand that a lot of times the parents have done some pretty terrible things to their children. But even then, I believe that in the vast majority of cases, maybe not all, but in the vast majority, the mother loves their child, and the father loves their child if they're involved too. Maybe addiction or mental illness or, you know, just sort of resource troubles got in the way of that. But I believe deep down that most people really do love their children, even if they've made terrible, inexcusable decisions. And to have your child ripped away from you, even if it was your fault, and to not know where they are or if they're safe or what's happening to them or when or if you'll see them again, I can't imagine how devastating that is. I'm starting to get choked up just thinking about if that would happen to me. I get panicky when my family watches Jack and I know exactly where he is and I know he's in great hands, you know? So for me, it was really important to let that mother know that I am a safe person, that I not only care about her baby, but I care about her, and that I'm not the enemy, that I am not here to take away your child. I am here because I believe in family reunification and I want her to do well so that she can be reunified with her daughter. And I think that goes a long way in building a relationship, because sometimes these kids are with you for years. And if you have made an enemy early on, it's going to make the experience miserable for everybody. So if you can show from the very beginning that you are one team and you are not enemies, that's huge. And so she did write back and we had a pretty good communication back and forth through visits. Which doesn't mean it was perfect. It was still really frustrating because there were times during the visit where I would write instructions of, okay, she needs to be fed at these times and she needs to have this much. And she would come back with bottles that had clearly not even been opened. And I would just be furious. Like, why are you not feeding your child during these visits? And that's kind of a whole other story. So it's not that this notebook magically made everything amazing, but I think it helped her. It helped me. And it also kept the child in the center of it. And that's the other thing that's easy to lose sight of, but you can't lose sight of it, is it's not about me. It's not about mom. It is about the child. And so, you know, that communication notebook makes it easier for everyone to focus their needs on this, focus their attention on the needs of the child and know what she needs. So I'm really happy I did that. And I still, in fact, have a little card that mom stuck in that notebook that was basically just this really heartfelt thank you note of, she thanked me for taking care of her daughter and, for loving her. And it just, I knew, I had a sense that not all parents would be like this. And I was right. And so I saved that just so in those moments where you do feel like you are at war with the parents, that you can remember why you are doing this. And that there are a lot of parents who are very, very grateful and who do really want to try and who are trying hard. So definitely steal that idea. So it was a really big adjustment for me. I think the hardest part wasn't necessarily dealing with any of the foster care particulars, although that was an adjustment too, the visits that I mentioned that didn't necessarily go so well. But for me, it was just adjusting to becoming a mother. I'm an only child. I have always lived alone since I was in college. So I've never really had to consider anybody else's needs except for my own. And that was a great life to lead. I just kind of did what I wanted to when I wanted to and, had just a really relaxed life. I read a lot. I went out to lots of brunches and dinners and just did a lot of writing at home. Like, it was just a really lovely life. And then all of a sudden, I had a baby who called the shots. And that was just the biggest adjustment for me of understanding, not understanding because I understood it, but just finding who you are when your life isn't your own anymore. And that is still an adjustment that I go through. I think sometimes the pendulum has swung too far the other way that I let my mother role be the only thing about me. When I had baby girl, I tried really hard to hang on to my own identity. I was determined to not be one of those mothers who is like the stereotypical hot mess after she has a kid. I still got my false eyelash extensions done every other week. I still got my gel manicure every other week. I still got my pedicures. I still did my hair and makeup every day. I still wore cute outfits. Like, it was really important for me to be seen, like physically seen, as a mother who had it all together. Like, wow, she hasn't let her appearance go at all. And then pretty quickly, I'd say like a month into it, I realized that I just couldn't do it, which is not to say that some mothers can. Like, if you can pull it off, like, you go for it. This is not a judgment on mothers who keep that up. But I found, especially being a single mother, that I had very limited time. And I had very limited energy, and to find childcare for me to go get my nails done or to get my eyelash extensions, like, I I didn't want to do that. I didn't really want to be away from her for those kinds of things. And then it just got exhausting. Like, I don't want to do this all the time. I'm tired, man. Like, if I have a free hour, I want to spend it catching up on sleep that I'm not getting at night, not, you know, getting my nails done. And so, you know, now 4 years later, as I mentioned, I think maybe the pendulum has swung too far the other way where I never do any of those things. And sometimes it's hard to recognize the person who I used to be, both physically and sort of figuratively. But that was a really big adjustment for me, is like letting some of those things go and being okay with that, and not trying to be a certain kind of mother because I felt like I had to be that certain kind of mother. Again, if it makes you happy to do all those things, then absolutely do it. But it wasn't making me happy. It was adding this added pressure to me that I didn't need on top of all of the other stress that I was feeling of being a mother for the first time on my own. And the other lesson that I learned was to accept and ask for help. As I mentioned early on, I was convinced that I didn't need a babysitter or a daycare for at least, you know, 8 months or so. I thought, nah, until she's like crawling, I can just keep her at home with me and do work while she naps. And this is just going to be so perfect and cozy. And it took a month, and then I was like, okay, to daycare we go, because it's just not doable to have a baby at home while you work full time. And I felt a lot of guilt about taking her to daycare. I remember when I dropped her off for the first time, I sobbed in the parking lot. And I had previously always kind of made fun of those mothers who did that. Like, oh my gosh, you're taking your kid to daycare. Like, they're not going to be scarred for this. And now here I was, just feeling like I was going to traumatize this child by going to daycare. And of course, now I feel little guilt about doing it. Sometimes I still feel guilty, but certainly not as much as I did at the beginning. But it made me better. I was able to work again. I was able to focus. I had a little bit of time for myself. And I think it was good for baby too, just to get a different kind of enrichment and interaction that she might not have been getting with me. So never again have I turned down childcare or help, because if somebody wants to watch my child, yes, please go for it. So that was my roller coaster of a first placement, a lot of adjustment. One more lesson that I learned was to utilize respite. So I've talked about respite before. Respite is when foster parents take a break and other licensed foster parents watch your child for a period of time. And it can be just for a day or it can be for a week. So sometimes foster parents will utilize respite if they have a planned vacation and for whatever reason they aren't able to take their foster child with them. You know, maybe they just need a break, right? There are lots of different reasons why you can utilize respite. But I utilized respite for 5 days. And it was really hard to say, hey, I need a 5-day break from this, because you don't want to feel like you're being a bad foster parent. You don't want to feel like you're being selfish. And I also felt like, well, man, this poor baby has been removed from the only home she knows. She's finally bonded with me, and now I'm going to send her to a new home for 5 days. Like, what kind of monster am I? But I was kind of at my breaking point because I was new to this, and it was just such a big change in my life. And again, I was doing it alone. I hadn't taken her to daycare yet at this point. So I just never had a break. And so for 5 glorious, amazing days, this fantastic foster family took her for 5 days, and I got to go back into my old life for 5 days. I, you know, went out with some friends and had fun and got to read and sleep in. And it was just really nice to know that I could take a break. And of course, you don't want to do that, you know, every month or maybe even every quarter. But when you are at that moment where you're like, I can't do this for a minute longer, that's what respite is there for. That's why it's a thing. And this is why it's also so important, where even if you're not entirely sure you want to be a foster parent yet, I say go ahead, go through with the process. It doesn't cost a single penny. There's you're not going to lose anything by getting your license, and you can be a respite parent. So you can just have a baby for 5 days and not have to, you know, go in fully as a foster parent, but still you can provide this amazing service to foster parents and get a feel for fostering to see if it might be a fit for you. So definitely needed if you want to dip your toe into the water. So baby girl stayed with me for about, I think it was like 6 or 7 months until she was moved with an aunt. And I used to be able to keep up with her. At one point after she left my home, her mother reached out to me through social media, and we exchanged phone numbers, and she would kind of, you know, every couple of months send me an update and say, you know, thank you. And then also I would creep on mom's Facebook page because, she did not have it locked down, as private. And so she would sometimes post pictures to her Facebook page and I could keep up with, baby girl. But, I haven't heard anything for probably 2.5 years now. It's been a while. And, her Facebook page hasn't been updated since the last time I looked, you know, 2.5, almost 3 years ago. So I don't know how she's doing, and, DCS is technically not allowed to tell me because she's not in my care anymore. So it's, you know, legally none of my business. So I really hope that, she is thriving and doing great and with her family, but I honestly have no idea. And that's the tough part about foster care, is not knowing what happens to them. And in many cases, once they move on, sometimes you'll make friends with a caseworker who will like kind of feed you information, even though they know they shouldn't, which I really appreciate. And I've had that with a couple of the kids that have been in my care. But a lot of times you don't hear anything, or you're left to sort of stalk on your own devices. So that is baby girl, the first little babe who made me a mommy. And I will always, always remember her and always love her. And she was just... oh, she was so beautiful, you guys. I mean, just just wait like 18 years and you're going to see her on a runway. Like, she was just a stunning little baby, and she had so much sass and attitude, and it was so fun to dress her up in these clothes. And everywhere we go, people would be like, oh my God, she is gorgeous. And I'm like, I know, she's so cute. So I am just so grateful for that experience, even though it was quite a roller coaster. So hopefully this gives you some insight into how that first call goes. I've probably had, gosh, well, I've had 9 placements total, but who knows how many calls I've received. Probably, I don't know. If I had to guess, I've had maybe 30, 40 calls, probably more than that, for placements. So we are open, and we are excited to get our next call for a placement. We had a baby girl for just a very short amount of time, a couple days, a few weeks ago. I guess it was maybe just about a week and a half ago. A 7-month-old baby girl. She was so cute, and Jack was so thrilled. Like, it was so adorable to see him with her. He would go, "Hi, honey," and he would kiss her forehead, and he was trying to feed her. And when she would cry, he would like kind of start freaking out, and he'd start to like bring her toys or give her a hug to try to figure out what was going on. So it was really sweet to see him just eagerly step into that role of big brother, even if it was just for a short period of time. And he is already asking, like, "When's a baby coming again?" I'm like, "I don't know, buddy. We'll see. We'll see when a baby is coming again." So who knows? I always get like this restless feeling before I get a call, like this little gut spidey sense that something is happening. And I always get a feeling like I want to nest. You know, I've heard pregnant women right before they deliver or sort of in their third trimester just get this desire to clean and to organize. And it's Mother Nature telling you that, like, get ready, it's a coming. And I get the same thing with fostering. And I've heard other foster and adoptive moms say that too. And I have been in that mode the past week of just cleaning and organizing and getting everything prepared and not putting anything off. That's one thing I've learned through fostering. When you are open for a placement, even though I am such a procrastinator, I do not procrastinate when I am open for a call, because you never know when, you know, your free time is going to end. So It's like, you know, when Jack is asleep by 7 o'clock at night, I've got 2 or 3 hours before I go to bed, to where I do things. And usually I just kind of, you know, watch Netflix or read a book or text. But lately I have been spending that time trying to be incredibly productive because, I don't know when those, free evenings are going to end because I might have a little one who, will be awake during that time. So anyway, it's taught me to not put things off. But hope you enjoyed this episode. As always, if you have questions or episode ideas or just want to reach out, you can always find me on Instagram at Eve Friedland, or you can email me elizabeth.friedland@gmail.com. Share this with a friend if you know somebody who's maybe had fostering on their heart, but they're not quite sure about it. I've had a lot of messages lately from single women saying, you know, I've thought about this, but I just don't know if it's doable. It is totally doable. It's hard. It's stressful, but it is more than doable. So send this to somebody who maybe just needs that sign or that nudge that it's time for them to take the leap. So thanks, guys. See you next episode.